Buddy, welcome to a Friday edition, two-hour edition, Bulldog Hour and Sportsline put together. The holiday is done. We are back at it. We wouldn't take more than one day away from Sportsland, and it's already been a fascinating day today with Coco Gauff's win at Wimbledon, and NBA held hostage day six. Kawhi Leonard waiting to make a decision, so we are watching both Greeny and Ramona Shelburne as we speak, as they do a rather unusual time for get up, which is the afternoon, which means after your lunchtime nap, I guess, get up again. And we'll see if anything happens between now and 4 o'clock. We'll certainly let you know, and then Nick and Nick will come up the zone, and the network will also have the updates. And look, we know Kawhi is enigmatic. We've all known that. I had mentioned to everybody, and it's not a newsflash, that's for sure, that you have two guys at the top of the totem pole here driving things forward in Kevin Durant and Kawhi Leonard, that they go about it differently because Kevin never lets anything go and Kawhi never comments on anything, but they both fundamentally head in unexpected directions. And so we know what's going on with Kevin and the rest of the league and a lot of free agents, second tier, Danny Green, etc., waiting for Kawhi to make the decision. And amazingly, he flew, as we know, to Toronto, and evidently has flown all the way back on that private jet to his great house outside of San Diego where friends and family are at. So we'll see if we get a decision today or not. It impacts this station greatly, of course, because the Lakers are the flagship of our NBA coverage. So we'll see. For us today, it means emails, tdad1@att.net. A ton to go over. When we're done, Nick and Nick will come up, 4 to 6. Giants, the red-hot, white-hot Giants on tonight, 6:35, the pre-7:15 first pitch. They're back home to play the Cardinals. And the A's, after the series against Minnesota, where they got a couple, they will head up to Seattle tonight, 6:45. That one on 790, while the Giants are on 940. We'll talk to CG in hour two with emails, but first, our great friend and always Friday visitor, the king of fantasy at NFL Network, the Culver City Madman himself. It's Marcus Grant, still shaking uncontrollably, and it has nothing to do with the earthquake. Sam, how you doing?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I feel like my kid is a true Californian because he slept through earthquakes. So, you know, he's one of us now.
You know what? In 62 and a half years, one of us has been around that long. I'm not going to say which one. Only twice have I been jarred by earthquakes. And, you know, we're kind of earthquake insulated here. We've said it. If this part of California, and I'm not talking about the guys in Kalinga, et cetera, that deal with the fault line, but here, right in the middle of Central California, if we have a major problem, the rest of the state is probably floating toward Hawaii at that point. But there was one in 1980 where the bed was shaken, and that will wake you up in a hurry. That's all I can tell you. I don't care how tired you might be. When your bed is shaking uncontrollably like you were an Exorcist IV, at that point, you're out of there. You growing up in a more earthquake-happy area, the Bay Area, did you go through much of it?
Occasionally. I mean, obviously, I you know, vividly remember 1989. You know, I was 12 years old for that one. You know, I was not in Los Angeles, obviously, in 94 when the Northridge quake hit, but obviously remembering that as well. But yeah, lately I haven't experienced too much of it. Somehow, I you know, while a lot of people around me seem to notice the big one a couple days ago, or yesterday, I guess it was, I didn't notice it at all. So I think I sort of lucked out, I guess, on that.
Well, to the folks down in the southern part of the valley and you know, everything going on, yeah, it's been jarring. I know that aftershocks today, and so we hope it's okay. In 1989, I was one of those many media members at Candlestick when the feeling was we were all going to end up on the pitching mound unexpectedly, okay, because that's what it felt like. Yeah. It felt like the entirety of the press box and everything just going to go flying toward the mound itself. We were all going to be out throwing the first pitch unexpectedly. But, you know, and that was a tragic situation for a lot of people. And, you know, I've mentioned this to you before. It's one of the things when you're a Giant fan prior to what happened at 10, 12, and 14, and I will get to the emails, particularly the ones that say the Giants are back, look out. Also, before I go any farther, our good friend Jonathan, if you didn't see the response to my email, because I might have made a comment about not appreciating the Dodger 5-walk walk-off. Although I'm going to tell you, it was preferable to the Bellinger home run last night. I'd rather see the But what I said to Jonathan and the long-suffering Dodger fans, if it's not this year, then when? And you and I will get into it, Em, because right now, this is the 32nd season. 31 years, but I count seasons because it's more painful that way. If this isn't the year, barring injury, that they win the thing, you guys may never win again. All right, so I just want to throw that out there. But the thing that was lost in 89 was it had been a scant 27 years since the Giants had been in the World Series. That's all, just 27 years. That's all it had been. And the only other time they had been in the series in San Francisco was that painful loss to the Yankees. And you know we had Bobby Richardson on that day. And asked him if he would have known the suffering was going to go on that long for the Giants, would you have stepped out of the way of McCovey's line drive? And you remember the silence on the air, right? like what kind of lunatic are you? Well, look, before 2010, 12, and 14, it was a legitimate question. At least I thought so. I might have been a cult of one. But in 89, what was washed away, and understandably so, by the tragic events and the 10-day break, that was the worst beatdown in the history of the World Series. The Giants never had a lead. Four games, and the Giants did not have one single lead at any point in four games. Nobody remembers that, and luckily, because of what happened 10, 12, and 14, I guess it really doesn't matter anymore, but it kind of laid there for a Giant fan saying, you know what? You finally got back, and the good Lord got so upset he tried to open up the earth and swallow the series whole. So, do any of us miss Candlestick? I know it's rubble now, rubble. But do you miss any part of Candlestick at all?
No, not even a little bit. I remember, you know, like when the Niners were closing the place out, and you know that right. Before that last with that Monday night game or whatever. You know, and all these like breathless tributes to Candlestick Park and how people, I'm like, this place was always, it was always bad. It was always unpleasant to be there. It was always hard getting in and out. The weather was never great. The parking lots would flood and be muddy and awful. And like the place was always bad. And now somehow, because it's not going to be used anymore, we're going to pretend that it was just this, you know, great edifice or whatever. Like, you know, we always disliked it. Let's not pretend on the way out that it's going to be something grand that we're all going to miss.
You're right. Tom Hanks the other night was talking on Kimmel about being a soda vendor at the Oakland Coliseum. And, you know, the Coliseum is taking its slings and arrows because of its age. But, Emma, I've mentioned this to you before. The Coliseum, when it was first put in the ground in the mid-60s, and you had all the great foliage up there. You didn't have Mount Davis, and you had the great look at the Oakland Hills and all of that. It was a very aesthetically pleasing park, you know. Or as, of course, Sal Bando said, even though they're winning titles, nobody showed up, called it the Oakland Mausoleum because it was that quiet, right? But the Coliseum was a nice place. Candlestick, you're correct, was never a nice place, ever. Heart Attack Hill, I mean, you know, it was aptly named. If people don't remember Heart Attack Hill, I mean, if you were a senior citizen or anybody like over 25, you might have been in jeopardy going up that thing. And there weren't a lot of great memories. I had told you, and it's absolutely true, that the one time that I thought the Giants were going to play at 6, it turned out they were playing at 7:30, so the family was not pleased because they were frozen solid by the start of the game. Went extra innings, and they ended up leaving me there with someone that they purported to have been a friend of theirs. Well, they were all in the car, my mom, dad, and sister. I don't think they even knew the guy, to be honest with you. I think they figured, you know what, we're cold, it's his fault. If he's hauled away and he's in the trunk of a car, that's his problem, all right? I think that's kind of what it was like. So that's what I read. It turned out fine, except Don Clendenin hit a home run and the Giants lost anyway. So I'm telling you, I don't miss it, and I cannot imagine we even headed in that direction, but one never knows where we're going. So let's get started here. Let's start right off the jump. I want to talk to you about what's going on with USC, because that is another major issue coming up. But I do want to talk about your beloved Dodgers, because I get so many emails, and you and I have known each other a long time, and for people to say that I have a bias against the Dodgers, seriously, have you ever seen me be anything but fair about your Dodgers? Keep in mind, you could be hung up on at any point here. So.
No comment? Can I say that?
That's good. That's better than I would have done if the roles were reversed. Yeah. It does hack me off, but I am going to come back and say this at the risk of angering Dodger fans, he says with a laugh. It has been 32 years, and I told you, Em, it was, if you were of my generation, it was extraordinarily frustrating because the teams came to California at the same time. But the Dodgers, who weren't that good, by the way, when they got here, suddenly won 2 years out. They win, and they kept on winning. And by the time we were done with the mid-60s, the Dodgers had already won three times and were headed, you know, to greatness. And the Giants were a good team that kept finishing second. So you have to understand my point of view. It got a little irritating about the time the fifth one went up, okay? But I will say that the Dodgers have done nothing for 32 seasons as far as winning World Series titles. I mean, what are you laughing at? I'm not saying that to be negative. Actually, I am. But is it frustrating for you since basically for the entirety of your adult life beyond, and never mind that you're a Bay Area trader, disloyal to his own particular geographic area. Let's leave that alone. Is it tough for you being in your 40s now and having a team that hadn't won for 32 years? Your comment. Or seasons. 31 years, 32 seasons.
It is frustrating. It is. That's why we are all, you know, at this point, we remain cautiously optimistic as a fan base about what potentially is to come. I mean, you know, I keep saying, like, last year, the Red Sox were just a flat-out better team. And you know, there was to get one was kind of, I think, you know, kind of the goal. To get one game was, you know, kind of a big deal right there. But, you know, the 2017 against the Astros, that one still stings, you know, to not only have battled so long, but to have game seven on, you know, at Dodger Stadium, to have that kind of, you know, sort of get away early, and even just to have Kershaw kind of come out of the bullpen and keep them in it, but the Dodgers not able to muster any real offense, that one still hurts. So I think this year everybody looks at this team and sees what they're doing and is cautiously optimistic. I think, you know, people will look at the bullpen and say that is right now the weak link, and hopefully they can do something to shore that up before they get into the playoffs. But, you know, there is reason to be hopeful. It's just a matter of whether or not they can finally get it done when it matters in October.
Well, I'll tell you what, and we'll move to email land here. I want to talk to you about Rick Courtright, what's going on at FC in just a second. But, Em, we have seen the Dodgers and Yankees in the series before. If they were to meet this year, if they're both fully healthy, it's really going to be bombs away. I was talking about the Yankees or the Twins maybe meeting at some point, divisional or league championship series. But if the Dodgers and Yankees do meet in the World Series, the best seats are going to be in the bleachers because, look, I don't know that two teams with that much power top to bottom of the lineup have met in a long, long time.
No, they haven't. I think a lot of it is because generally we've seen in the past teams with a lot of power don't always get as far as the World Series. I mean, and, you know, and for as much as everybody talks about, you know, we've talked about launch angles and generating power or what have you, the teams that have won World Series over the last few years, not only do they have power, but they still sort of play in a more traditional way. They run, they move runners over, they figure out ways to manufacture runs when the power isn't there just because, you know, the pitching is going to be better. So I think you're right. If those two teams meet, it will be sort of home run derby every night there. But it just traditionally we've seen that the teams that rely on the long ball, a lot of times that dries up when you start facing better pitching staffs in the playoffs.
You're right. And speaking of teams that play that way, you know, the Twins just left Oakland, and I think, if I remember right, they have, here we are, just shy of the All-Star break, and they have 22 stolen bases total. I don't know. I'm just saying, I don't think, and I think Buxton has about 90% of them, right? I don't think that the Twins do a lot of running. So in that regard, the Yankees or the Dodgers are like track teams, but I know this. Fox would love to have a Yankee-Dodger World Series. You know that. That's for sure. And for me, it just leaves nobody to pull for. Again, 2010, 2012, and 2014. We'll always have Paris, Marcus. That's all I can tell you. All right, Emma. More serious note here. As a Giant fan with a four-game winning streak, we're fairly giddy at the moment, right? Boy, if we could just get to that Padre pitching staff every single game, things would be great. The situation with Courtright... He's claiming as a whistleblower he was run out of there at FC. I guess there are two issues. One, and I know, look, it's your alma mater. It's Christopher's alma mater. Okay, Scott Bemis, Ralph Wood, a lot of you guys, right, are still bleeding Trojan red and yellow. What do you call it? You guys don't call it scarlet. What do you call it?
Cardinal and gold.
Okay, whatever. Just like UCLA used to have Columbia blue. I guess that's disappeared now, right? I have no idea. I'm not going to ask you what UCLA's colors are, okay? OJ tried to change the colors. There's a Westwood joke in there. I'm not going to get near. I guess I did, didn't I? Anyway, with Courtright, the problem, Marcus, for the university beyond the usual scandal, which seems to be hitting everything at FC, medical school, you name it. As far as this goes, do you worry as a Trojan fan that there are going to be NC2A investigations now further into the allegations, never mind the civil suit that's being filed?
Yeah, I think it's a real concern that, you know, as the civil suit goes along, and you know, certainly the NC2A, we have seen in recent years, them, you know, sort of looking into allegations that have come up because of whatever legal investigations. I mean, the fact that they were recently working with the FBI, behind this whole lot of basketball issues recently. So I think if you are around the university, if you are a fan of the program, I think you do have to be concerned that what these allegations are going to open up potentially another investigation into a program that certainly has had more than its share of them over the last few years. So, I think it's another potential frustration for the fans around what, you know, has been a very troubled tenure for Lynn Swann. If you're Clay Helton, this is absolutely the last thing you need when you were already on the hot seat and a lot of people wanted to see you go. So now if this program is potentially under investigation, and if there are potential penalties that come along with it that hamstring the program even more, I think it makes it even more difficult. So I think there are a lot of reasons to be concerned around Heritage Hall right now.
You know, we talk about it so often, Marcus, in regard to professional sport, because the guys have to go to press conferences all the time and they have the assembled media around the lockers and all that stuff, that anything like this professionally is a distraction. In college, because you're a little bit more cocooned from all of this, is it a potential distraction at all, or is the team itself, and I bring this up because you know that the Bulldogs are going to be there at 7:30. They better be there before 7:30, going to kick it off. So I assume the bus is going to roll in prior to it. Although I remember one time Fresno City College was playing Contra Costa College, and it looked like Jeff Spicoli showed up. We're waiting for Contra Costa to get there. Game is delayed. Suddenly the bus rolls in, goes through the parking lot, goes right to midfield, and everybody kind of rolls out of the bus, and then they got killed by about 70, so they probably shouldn't have shown up. Let's assume that both teams are there on time on the 31st of August. Any of this going to affect the Trojans on the field that the Bulldogs see? Any of this stuff?
I doubt it. I would imagine, you know, the coaching staff probably has to answer questions about it. I would think the athletic department will have to answer questions about it. But, you know, the nature of NCAA investigations is such that, you know, these things tend to drag out over a few years. And so I would suspect that, you know, for a lot of the players there, you know, I don't know, maybe it's sort of background noise, but I think, you know, if anything were to happen, by the time any investigation would conclude, most, if not all, of those players may be on their way to somewhere else.
You and I have talked about the heyday under Pete Carroll, and it certainly did not end the way anybody wanted it to. But it also is still remembered fondly at SC because of the national championships and the long gap before, and now we're starting to see the gap after. I'm not saying Pete Carroll's ever coming back to SC, but is it your foregone conclusion here that if Helton does not get this thing turned all the way pronto, that he is gone? I guess what I'm asking is how much patience, because I know it's not much, but the very moneyed alums of SC have about what's going on right now, because mediocrity is not going to play very well there long term.
Yeah, everybody sort of wanted him to be gone after last year. You know, I mean, the way they sort of limped to the finish, especially losing to UCLA late in the season, right, that was not what anybody wanted. And I think the expectation was that Clay Helton was not going to survive. the thought originally was that Cliff Kingsbury was waiting in the wings to come take over the job. Yeah, obviously, right. we saw what happened there. The great era of Cliff Kingsbury as offensive coordinator for the full – was it even a full week? I'm not even sure if it was a full week that he was employed by USC.
In fairness to Kingsbury, he had to even go to Canton to be inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. That's part of the problem, right? Because evidently he has a storied resume that none of us know about. Is that correct?
I guess so. I think – the leash is going to be pretty short on Clay Helton. You know, I mean, there's talk about whether or not the buyout is what is kind of holding things up right now. But I just think that if this program does not turn around in short order, I think there are going to be some people with deep pockets who will figure out that situation in order to try to bring somebody. You know, look, we've already got Matt Leinart and Reggie Bush claiming that if things go bad, they're going to get on the phone to Urban Meyer and try to bring him out to L.A. I mean, I think that sort of tells you how people feel about the situation right now.
Yeah, we were talking. You and I were talking about that several months ago, and I don't know. Urban Meyer obviously is a guy who coached at Utah, so he understands what it's like to be out west. I don't know. The reality, Marcus, of this Power Five stuff and what's happening with the Pac-12. Can you say that there's no reason that USC shouldn't be back to where the Trojans used to be? And we saw it under John McKay, saw it under John Robinson, certainly saw the renaissance with Pete Carroll. Has the landscape changed that much for all of West Coast football, or do you say it just takes the right guy, that truly in college it only takes one at the top to get the right guys, and SC still has the gravitational pull of SoCal, of history on its side, or does that not mean that much to 16- and 17-year-olds looking to be recruited these days?
No, I mean, I think it still does mean something. I mean, I think you can see it in the fact of just how the general public reacts. I mean, you know, in the last few years, whenever SC has started the year in the rankings and has underwhelmed on the field, you know, just kind of the way people sort of react to that. And I think there is still definitely the cachet there. But I think, you know, what we have seen is a program that, one, has not recruited as well as it believes it has. You know, and I think part of it is that you mentioned Pete Carroll. I think there has just been this insistence on sort of holding on to that era by trying to bring in guys that were around the team or around the program when Pete Carroll was there. And I think for the fan base now, I think they've reached a point where it's like at some point they've got to just try to bring in new blood. That for as great as that era was, as much fun as it was to watch those teams, that time has passed and it's time to try to do something new. So I think there's still a belief that this program can be something great again. You know, obviously they're in a very deep recruiting area when it comes to talent being in Southern California. And, you know, look, whether or not, however it shakes out on the field or on the court of play, I think UCLA will always have that basketball cachet and USC will always have that football cachet. And it's just a matter of finding the coach or the person at the top of the program that can sort of bring it back to its glory.
Any handle on what Bulldog fans can expect from the team on the field for the Trojans on August 31? I mean, the just never mind the next year or Helton, whatever. Just for that opening game, we know the transition here. There's a lot of talent coming in, but a lot of holes to fill, and that's a tough time for Fresno State to be at the Coliseum. This is one of those things, Marcus, where if they could play the game in November, Fresno State would probably be a lot happier, particularly because SC does not want to ever see Fresno State in November again, ever. But does this team that Helton will put on the field on the 31st of August figure to be formidable at that point?
I mean, it's a team, I mean, just like Fresno State is sort of transitioning after losing some talent, that the Trojans are sort of the same way on both sides of the ball. I mean, I think one of the big things will be kind of figuring out who the wide receiver core is going to be and then how this group is built. I think they feel confident with Daniel at quarterback. So, I mean, I think that's one place where I think they're sort of solidified. But, you know, again, it's also going to be a new offensive coordinator. I mean, Graham Harrell comes in, and we're not really sure what that offense is going to look like. So I think this is going to sort of be a matchup of two teams that are very much trying to find themselves going into the new season.
Well, I'll tell you what, the fact this thing ended up on ESPN at 7:30, as I mentioned to you, tells me that not only does ESPN always want to treat the Trojans right, but Marcus, clearly the 22 Bulldog wins the last couple of years had to play into it, because even though, yeah, I know it's 10:30 in the East, it's a game that you would have thought when it was lined up it might be a Pac-12 game. Are you surprised at all, to Pac-12 network game, surprised at all that this thing ended up on the mothership when it did?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I think you're right. It just, it sort of felt like kind of a midday Pac-12 network game that, you know, gets buried in most markets. So, you know, I as much as I know fans down here lament having the late starts, I know Pac-12 fans aren't really big on those sorts of things because it tends to mean you get ignored a little bit. It is, you know, as we've talked about many, many years in the past, that it is sort of a spotlight game in the sense that, you know, you are on ESPN and you are in a situation where you're not really running up against a whole lot of other things. So I think that is a benefit for it.
Well, the other thing is, and this, and I'm not going to compare it to the late start in 2005 because, again, SC was in the middle of that undefeated run at home. The Bulldogs were a very good team, and the game was hyped a great deal. I think it kicked, if I remember right, at 7:15, I think is what the scheduled kick was that night. It wasn't going to matter what time you played it. You were going to see 20-plus thousand Bulldog fans there. This one, even though Fresno State is coming off of a very successful seasons back-to-back, if this one would be played at, say, 12:30 or so, I think there'd be a lot of Bulldog fans still who would have said, you know what, I'd love to go to the game, but there's no way I can go there and tailgate and watch the game, and I might have to work or the kids might have soccer or whatever. And the 7:30 start, at least from my point of view, even though it could require people to stay over or you at least have to make sure somebody's got some rest somewhere, the non-football fan, right, that's sleeping in the car, you know, that kind of thing. I think you're going to see a lot more Bulldog fans there because at 7:30, I think a lot of people are going to say this is a same-day trip now and there's time to tailgate first. Will SC have their big crowd? Because as you're well aware, in 05, even though the Bulldogs had tremendous representation, you had 90,000-plus there all the time because the Trojans are winning. We talked about it when the Bulldogs went to UCLA. They're, you know, the Rose Bowl, they always kind of cringe where you're going to see so many Fresno State fans in relation to UCLA fans that it kind of became a draw. Is there any concern that Bulldog fans can not take over the Coliseum but have the kind of impact that they didn't have when SC was drawing huge?
I think so. I mean, I think it's something that people are going to consider. I think the fact that it is the first game of the year will, by nature, draw more SC fans. But, yeah, it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be a sellout. I'd be shocked if the place sold out for that first game of the year. But I just think because it's the first game, maybe it will be. And also, look, there are a lot of people who remember 2005, and I'm sure there will be a lot of talk about trying to make sure that Fresno State fans don't necessarily try to take the place over for that game.
You're right. Of course, the last time the Bulldogs were there, it was not a great time for Fresno State, that's for sure. I mean, it was one of those deals coming off of a great year, but you lost, you know, Derek Carr and everybody. Actually, you know, that weird situation where the Bulldogs and Trojans played back-to-back games, right? Because they played the bowl game against one another and then started the 2014 year against each other. Is there still a bit of dismissiveness? I mean, you talk about the fans that remember 05, but for an SC fan in general, is it, wow, we're playing lesser opposition? Is that sort of how they view this, or do you know?
No, I mean, I don't think so, and I don't say this disrespectfully at all. I think right now Trojan fans are just more concerned about their own team. I mean, just with everything that's gone on in the last couple of years, on the field and off the field and what have you, I just think that SC fans are more worried about what is going on within its own program and just trying to make sure they put together a representative team to put out there on the field. And I don't know that it necessarily matters who the opponent is going to be in that first game. They just want to make sure that things are sort of on the up and up with them.
Well, you and I will talk about it, of course, as we get closer to the game in August, and we're getting there in a big hurry. But the last thing before we go to other things, and time always goes by too fast when you're on with me, and I appreciate the time. When you view this coming around the bend, are you going to be surprised if Clay Helton is the coach in 2020, given the circumstances?
Yeah. I mean, unless something major happens, unless this team really turns it around and you know, kind of runs through the schedule and you know, wins the Pac-12 or what have you, you know, if it looks like it has the last couple of years, I will be very surprised if he's the head coach this time next year.
And are you fairly confident the next head coach isn't going to be Jeff Tedford? I mean, because we never say never here. I guess what I'm asking is, if the Bulldogs put up with this transition of talent, if they put up another 10-win-plus season, Marcus, I don't care what people say about glamorous names. Teddy is well-known in SoCal, not only because he grew up there, but because what happened with Cal, et cetera. I mean, is there that possibility hanging out there? If the Bulldogs go there and win on the 31st, I guess what I'm getting at, and they have a great year, do we have to cringe here about that offer coming down the pike, or will SC go younger at this point?
I think there is always reason to be concerned. You know, just because I think for a school like SC or any of the Power Five schools, what have you, I think, you know, you wouldn't be doing your due diligence if you didn't at least ask, you know. And then you've got a guy like Tedford who has done a great job with that program from, you know, where it was when he took it over to what he's done the last couple of years. I just think that, you know, any school would at least make the offer and then leave it up to Teddy to decide what he wants to do. So I know that fans up there don't necessarily want to hear that, but I think that's the truth.
Yeah, I think you're right. The other thing is, more than any other sport, when we talk about it only takes one, and maybe basketball runs alongside of this in college, if you can keep a head coach in place and he's able to keep that staff at a mid-major level with continuity, knowing you're going to lose guys, he has lost guys along the way. You know, you beat Arizona State and you turn around and what's the response? Okay, let's take your assistant coaches, right? That's what Herm decided to do. But if you can keep a coach here, you've got a real chance for long-term success. But, Em, I will ask you, particularly at the mid-major level, how tough is it if you've got to replace coaches at this level? I mean, to me, it looks to be the most extraordinarily difficult thing to maintain any continuity at this level, as opposed to a USC where name recognition of the school isn't as much as the name recognition of the coach.
It's incredibly hard, especially because, look, coaches, assistant coaches, they have ambition too. You know, I mean, these are guys who want to move on, whether it's to a bigger school, whether it's to a head coaching opportunity somewhere else. I mean, these are people who have career aspirations as well. You know, and unfortunately to be outside the Power Five, you know, just sort of means that, you know, it is potentially a stepping stone to something else. And you'll always have people who just like being in a certain place and want to stay, whether it's, you know, that they feel comfortable professionally, if they have children right in the area that they want to keep in school. But, I think it's always going to be, unfortunately, the plight of the quote unquote mid-major, just trying to keep staffs intact for years.
Yeah, the finances around it without the Power Five money, and the fact you're right, you not only have assistant coaches who in a general sense are younger, more upwardly mobile in their desire, also they have younger families, which means the mouths to feed and the paychecks are better at the Power Five level. But I'll tell you what, Fresno State is very fortunate that Tedford is here, and I think all things being equal, Jeff's intent is to stay here. I mean, he's only 57. I say that because it means he's got plenty of time coaching-wise. He could leave. He's still young enough to have that energy. He could leave. I don't think he will. But you know what? You never say never. And if somebody comes knocking with that offer, you can't refuse. You have to accept it. So we'll see what happens. And also with the assistant coaches, as Patty will mention to us many times, as a head coach at this level, you have to have that mental and actual physical checklist of guys ready to go, because you never know who is going to be taken off your staff and brought to an Arizona State or what have you. All right, Emmer, I want to ask you here about Kawhi Leonard since you're down there. This has been a crazy situation. Billy had emailed in and said it may not have been his intent, but Kawhi is right now negatively impacting a lot of people by dragging out this decision. I'd mentioned, you know, this is NBA held hostage day six because June 30th was the first day of free agency. Marcus, I don't think Kawhi's doing this to be self-centered in any way or to say, look at me. But do you think it's gone on long enough, since we know from Caponomics there are only three teams that can afford him now, the Lakers, the Clippers, and back with Toronto. And I've said I think it's a no-brainer. You go back and sign the 1-1 with Toronto so that you can have the 10-year Supermax deal. In 2 years, you can come home, and if the deck is cleared with the Lakers and you like it, meaning LeBron's toward the end of his career, but AD is solidly in there, and Kuzma, you do that. If the Clippers get a couple of more big-time bodies, you go there. And what is taking so long? Should it be taking this long, or should his due diligence be done by now?
I mean, yeah, at this point, you have to think that all the potential permutations that are possible, have been made known to him. I don't know why it's taking so long. Honestly, I think I'm sort of amused by it, watching the NBA just kind of like spin for all these days, yeah, just trying to wait for him to make a decision. Because, I mean, look, and I know people want a decision to be made, and I know there are other free agents that are out there, that are going to make a decision based on what he does. But in reality, we're not going to play any basketball games that matter for, what, another 3 months, basically. So, I'm curious to see when it happens. I saw the latest reports that it's not expected to happen today, and that, for whatever reason, NBA insider Chris Carter, that we all know, is saying that he's not going to sign a short-term deal. That has confused me as much as anything, how Chris Carter somehow has become the conduit to Kawhi Leonard's thinking. I have no idea why.
Another guy who's the claw. Yeah. That's why.
Okay. Right. In theory, you would think that, he knows everything that there is to know about the situation. Why he's delaying it, I have no idea. I know that it has created quite a bit of tension here in Los Angeles, because Laker fans realize that, Kawhi coming or not coming could be the key to them being an NBA Finals contender right now, or maybe having to wait a little bit.
Well, what's tough for the Lakers is they cleared that $32 million. They cleared the deck, and you would like to spend it on other free agents, and already guys like Seth Curry, who they would like to have signed, and I think wanted to come to L.A. He couldn't wait, Marcus. He had an offer, an $8 million a year offer. He's going to take it. It's happening with a lot of players, and I'm not talking about the Boogie Cousins kind of situation, because his market is sort of, if there's room somewhere, great. He's not going to probably be going anywhere else. I do know this. There is angst, legitimately, because I talked to somebody in the Laker front office about Andre Iguodala. They want Iguodala there, and they want him there, Marcus, to be what you and I talked about. The guy you put in bubble wrap during the regular season, and you play him relatively sparingly, and you unleash him on the league in the playoffs. So I will ask you about Iguodala. Is Andre in a position where he is being hurt and the Lakers are being hurt by this non-decision right now? Because that's a $17 million contract, and if there's no buyout, which is what Memphis says, you've got to make a deal. Is this really impacting the Lakers greatly?
I think it is. Yeah, I mean, look, they only have, right now, they only have, a few roster spots actually accounted for, right? They've got to fill in the gaps, but where you fill in the gaps or how you fill in those gaps is going to be impacted by whether or not, you've got Kawhi Leonard on the books, or if not, how do you figure that out? How do you fill out the rest of that roster? So, yeah, it is impacting the Lakers. I think for a guy like Iguodala, it probably will impact him potentially financially, not in terms of opportunity, because I think, teams still realize the value of having a guy like that, even if he's not nearly the scorer he once was early in his career. He's still a great defender. He's still a great team guy that everybody would want to have in the locker room, but potentially could impact how much a team is able to pay him, depending on what happens with Kawhi.
Well, the thing with Memphis is really interesting, because the assumption, and I think justifiably so, was the Warriors gave up a draft pick. It's one of the things about the D'Angelo Russell deal. They gave up a couple of number ones. But the biggest thing was, the assumption was, the buyout would be there, because I think the contract was $17.2 million. I believe that's what was left in this final year. But that they just assumed that Memphis would go ahead and negotiate the buyout. Then Iguodala would be free to proffer his wares wherever he wanted. And more than likely, that would be either Houston or L.A. And I do think the Lakers' perfect situation, because like I said, Marcus, put him in bubble wrap and just wait for April, right? That's what you want to do, because Andre is a bit injury prone these days, but in spurts can be tremendously impactful. But with Memphis now saying, you know what, not so fast, we'll go ahead and wait and make you not only take the contract rather with having a buyout, but you're going to have to give us a draft choice too. This is going to become a game of chicken pretty soon, right? They're going to play one side against the other, knowing fully well they don't want to keep him long term. But if you are a Laker fan, or if you're a Clipper fan, or a Houston Rocket fan, are you looking at this in that regard with angst, saying you cannot leave us hanging until we can at least make the kind of move we need? If you're in Houston, are you saying, you know what, you're fouling us up, or are you doing us a favor by doing this because it's messing with the Lakers, or will the Lakers just hold that open no matter what to see?
I mean, I think if you're the Lakers, you're sort of all in on Kawhi right now, right? Like you really have, you've done everything you can to set up for this moment. I mean, you know, they were set up for this before Kawhi ended up in Toronto, even waiting for this potentially to happen.
Right.
So you're sort of all in here. If you're the Rockets, I mean, I don't know what you do because you would certainly love it. But, you know, if these reports are to be believed, then you've got this turmoil between Chris Paul and James Harden. I mean, that is sort of the nucleus of this team. And if that's not in harmony, then, you know, I don't know that adding Kawhi necessarily makes anything better. But I guess there is some joy in knowing that potentially it is fouling up what the Lakers want to do, you know, knowing that they potentially can become your chief rival in the Western Conference all of a sudden if Kawhi somehow lands there.
All I know is this. With Iggy, if there's been anybody used to dysfunction and anger between teammates, being a Warrior, he's not going to be bothered by what's going on with Harden and Chris Paul. All right. Last thing for you, and again, Em, the hour has flown by. I didn't get to some of the very meaningful emails. If you read some at the bottom, you'll know why I avoided them, okay? Trust me. Particularly the one about my run-in with a clown. We'll get to that someday. Yes, there was a run-in with a clown, if you remember. Really unbelievable, too. But if I were to ask you right now in the last 45 seconds, where is Kawhi going to be for at least the next couple of seasons?
I still think he goes back to Toronto. Yeah. You know, they're building something there. They just won a championship. They can offer him more money than anybody else. I think he stays in Toronto for at least a couple more years and then maybe decides what he wants to do after that.
Yeah, I think it's the one and one. It's what Durant did with the Warriors. One and an option for two, and you take that option, and in 2 years, in 2021, you're still a very young guy. Now you're eligible for the Supermax, and you can see exactly what the lay of the land is back home. You know where the Clippers headed, you have been headed. You know where the Lakers had gone, and you can make a decision, tip your hat, and if you pick up another title in Toronto, great. If not, it's just a couple of seasons. You never say never. I don't see him signing a five-year deal in Toronto, but I also don't see him jumping back to L.A. until he knows what each team is doing. I hope I'm right about that. I don't want to see him back west. That's all I'm telling you. Dave Shepard's listening. Dave, no offense. All right, listen, Marcus, appreciate it, my friend. Always great talking to you. How are things going with Little M these days? Everything all right?
Things are great. He's progressing. Had a great 4th of July. Things are great.
All right, well, I'm glad to hear it. Your son is not crying himself to sleep anymore, nor is mine, but that's the difference between us. I'll talk to you later, Em. I'll talk to you next Friday. Take care.
All right, take care, Tom.
All right, guys. Marcus Grant, NFL Network, NFL.com. We'll take a break, wrap up Hour 1, get you ready for CG and Hour 2 on 50,000 Watt, 940 ESPN. Everybody, welcome back. About 2 minutes to go, Hour 1. CG will join me. Emails in Hour 2. Thanks again to Marcus for his time. He's down at NFL Network, NFL.com. Joseph just emailed in and asked if everybody's sure that Kawhi Leonard actually went to Toronto and is indeed back in San Diego, just a little bit outside of San Diego at his new house, or maybe his existing house. I know he bought some other thing. He can afford to buy whatever he wants. Joseph, nobody knows for sure. That was definitely Kawhi getting off the plane, however, in Toronto. Whether he's back in SoCal, that's what everybody's reporting, that he flew back on the actual aircraft that was supplying him the trip out, which means the owner of the Raptors was responsible for picking up the bill and all of that. And I still say that all things being equal, Kawhi is going to end up signing in Toronto for the one and one, which would be the best compromise in my opinion. 2 years there, get the Supermax. He also has an option out in that after the first year if he doesn't care about the Supermax. I think that's what's going to happen, but I'll tell you what, the one flying the ointment, if that is the scenario, is why in the world he would bother to go all the way back to L.A., never mind flying. I could see, okay, he flew to Toronto because he wanted to meet face-to-face. Also, I think he still has a residence of some type there. But if you're going to go all the way there and fly all the way back to Los Angeles now back home and make a decision that requires you to go all the way back to Toronto again, That doesn't make a lot of sense. I suppose they can get the deal done in L.A. and Toronto, and he can sign the contracts. He doesn't have to worry about getting back to Raptorland, and with the Las Vegas part of Summer League, the stuff done in Sacramento, the few games there in Sacto and Salt Lake City, with everybody in Vegas, I guess they could go to Vegas, get it all done there, and then Kawhi does not have to worry about getting back to Toronto right now. That is a long six-hour flight, that's for sure. We'll see what he does. If it happens in hour two, we'll tell you about it on KFIG Fresno. Welcome back. It's hour two, the mail hour, as we head to 4 o'clock, and then Nick and Nick will come up with his own. The red-hot San Francisco Giants playing their way right back, no, they're not, into the NL West race. I thought I'd give it a shot. They're fighting for their jobs, ladies and gentlemen. They're seeing the trading deadline coming up at the end of the month, and they've decided they're going to play now. It's either that or the Padre pitching staff was really bad at the start of the week at Petco, but the Giants have won four straight. They're back home. The Cardinals come in tonight. Later start 7:15. We've talked about the Giants starting 6:45 in the weekdays, except on Fridays, 7:15, the old start time, so 6:35 pregame show, and I'm sure the Giants will be in the old throwback oranges tonight, so much so that Darrell Evans is starting at first base. That's a Giant joke from a long time ago. The A's are up in Seattle after they had a good series against the Twins at home, and the A's and the Mariners will start at 6:45 over on 790. By the way, in Oakland yesterday, there was a 100-year-old World War II veteran who threw out the first pitch. He did a great job, and if you looked at this guy, you would swear he's maybe 70. It was unbelievable to see this guy at age 100. He's there in tennis shoes, khaki pants, no walker, no help. He is just, he goes up in the stands and puts his feet up on the seat in front of him, which you can do in Oakland because not a lot of people are there. But he just looked like a guy who just retired, for goodness sake, 100 years old. So, you know, that old line by Dom Herrera, his cousin, when he saw Jack LaLanne at 90, he goes, you know, Dom, I hope I look that good when I'm 90. And Dom said, Petey, you don't look that good right now, when he was in his 30s. So, all right. Anyway, baseball, both stations tonight. And one last note, we are now at 6 o'clock Eastern, 3:06 Pacific, and it's day six. Kawhi Leonard holds the NBA hostage. No further reporting that we can bring you. So that is a backdrop. Our great friend, your host, 3 to 6, Monday through Thursday, 7 to 9, Friday morning, and always with us. And Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we share some time on our two shows. It is CGP himself, Christopher Gabriel. Christopher, how you doing?
Well, oh, great one. Let me change what you just said a moment ago. I was just at the grand reopening of Jimmy Antonucci's Italian Deli in Coors Gold, and right there, sitting at a two-top, was Kawhi Leonard eating a veal parmesan with a side of fries.
That would explain why they thought they diverted the flight from from Toronto to San Diego.
That's made a little stop, you know, because you and I both know at Jimmy Antonucci's, they do a great veal there, a great veal parmesan, and I wasn't sure it was him until I saw the New Balance mid-high tops, and then I knew it was him.
And he had one hand in a pocket, and he was leaned forward. Although, you know what? This town, talking about Fresno, has seen its share of superstars on a regular basis. We talk now, as you know, about Giannis Antetokounmpo being here because he is dating Pat Riegelsberger's daughter, and he's here all the time. And just thinking about it earlier today, when Rod Higgins was the roommate of Michael Jordan, and Rod and Bobby Anderson and Tyrone Bradley had started their camp, Michael Jordan used to come into this town all the time. There was no surprise seeing Michael hanging out, particularly about 1 o'clock in the morning. He'd be shooting pool somewhere. And my favorite story, I brought it up before, CG, Raj Mathai, our great friend who's up at Cron in San Francisco and was at Channel 24 here for a number of years, he was at Bulldog Brewing in Fig Garden Village at 1 o'clock in the morning, and he was shooting 8-ball, and he said that Michael comes walking in the door, and he's got, he's not playing, Raj is playing, and Raj has got the nine ball lined up to win, and Michael is putting $100 bills down on the table in front of him going, how small is that pocket getting now? How about now? So, nice to have the disposable income to just go. If that had been me, it would have been dollar bills. It would have had nearly, I think, the impact, Christopher. But so you're telling me Kawhi was up north, huh? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, he was up north. And just a couple of things based on what you just said. You know, when I lived in Chicago was during the first three-peat and the beginning of the second three-peat.
Right.
And as you would imagine, Tony, the stories, because I was in theater then, but I knew a lot of people in restaurants, in the restaurant industry. The stories of Michael showing up exactly as you just laid out and to all hours of the night, because Chicago, like New York, is a very late night town where a lot of clubs and places don't open until 11 o'clock at night. The stories of MJ showing up and getting involved in late night card games and bringing the sun up across Lake Michigan were right. Legendary. And the part about Giannis, listen, As 100%, you know, born and bred, full-blooded Greek, I'm a little bitter that, you know, I contacted through an intermediary. I tried to get a hold of Giannis. I had a whole tray of baklava ready for him, homemade. You know, he left town, didn't take it. So, but, you know, what are you going to do?
You were part of the great ESPN promo, the one where they're breaking plates around him, and he goes, nobody ever does that in Greece. So that's just one of the best of all time.
Well, we did that at my house, but that was because people were ticked off about something.
I was going to say, it happened to my family at Christmas time, whenever we had to rent the hall because nobody wanted, like, the entirety of the family at their place to trash it. And we'd rent, like, you know, one of the Edison Social Club or whatever, and it would always end up with my mom firing those big, heavy plates at my Uncle Virgil, who was complaining about the length of my hair. That's pretty much how Thanksgiving or how Christmas went all the time. So there was a different reason for the plates being broken at that point, right?
So I can so relate to that, because any time that there was a wedding or any function in my family, there were a couple of what we call the off-the-boat Greek uncles that you knew as soon as somebody raised their voice, that was going to be followed by glass breaking, and then it was on all the time.
That's right. That's right. That's what family gatherings are for.
Yes.
All right. The update here with, again, NBA held hostage day six because free agency started on the 30th. Our good buddy, longtime friend, and the king of NBA media, Adrian Wojnarowski, just said that all the meetings are done. And I will throw to you, CG, what I was talking about last hour. I had mentioned many times during the week, I really thought the no-brainer was the 1-1, the year and the option, still in Toronto, stay with that team, get to the Supermax, and you can see what the lay of the land is more clearly in Los Angeles. You're still a young guy, and you kind of run your course in Toronto without being there for 5 years. Particularly when he was flying to Toronto, I thought that was going to happen. To find out now that he not only flew there, but evidently after all the meetings have been done now with all three teams, he has flown all the way back to outside of San Diego. Does that tell you anything that he would fly all the way back or with everybody who's anybody now in Las Vegas, including the Toronto Summer League team, that it's just as easy now to just flip right over to Vegas to get this thing finalized with whatever team he chooses?
Yeah, it's really confusing, and in some respects it builds into your email from Billy, which I'll let you get into. I think I've maintained this all along, Tony, and I still hold to this. Whether he's going to Toronto or one of the LA teams, and I really think with the LA team we're talking about right now that would be in the mix would be the Lakers and not the Clippers. There's just nothing that suggests to me that the Clippers would be in play here. But I've thought all along that he's done what he's doing. I he's taken meetings to take meetings, but I simply refuse to believe. Rick Bucher, longtime NBA writer, is one who actually agrees with me, or maybe we say I agree with him, that he knows exactly what he's doing. You know, Tony, in today's NBA, in today's sports world, if he's going to sign with Toronto, it doesn't matter if he's on vacation in Paris. He can make his announcement through his agent. He can contact his favorite person in the media after his agent and give that release. I'm not sure what to make of this anymore. You had the presidential motorcade in Toronto, which that in and of itself was worthy of a 30 for 30. I mean, him getting there, I mean, he's better taken care of than Pierre Trudeau. My gut still, even though I think your logic on this with the 1 plus 1 or the 2 plus 1, I think your logic is better than mine. I'm still holding to the idea that he's coming to the Lakers. But I think we're probably going to hear in the next day or two, and I referenced Billy's email. He is holding up a lot of NBA teams, but I don't know. I don't think that he really cares, and I don't think that it's that he doesn't care. He's trying to be a jerk about it. I think he's worried about, you know, how are we going to do the announcement? How do we position this? How are we framing this? I think that's the only thing that's really on his mind. I don't think he's worried about what other NBA teams are doing, Tony.
You may be right. And I'll tell you, of the three that are in play right now, the two LA teams and Toronto, the one that would be impacted the most as far as waiting on the decision, the Lakers, because they have seen guys like Seth Curry go by the boards when they wanted him there. There's no doubt, as we were talking last hour, CG, that the Lakers would really like to have Andre Iguodala. There's no question. I don't think they expected the non-buyout that they've now gotten from Memphis, who's understandably trying to leverage picks to the future, and that's what they did to get Andre, and now they're looking at, you know what, we're not going to go with the buyout. We're going to see if we can go ahead and trade him and get something else for him. And if you're the Lakers, you're looking at it saying, you know what, we'd like to make a deal, just like a Danny Green deal, but Kawhi is holding us up about this because we've got to leave that cap space for him. And until we know, we can't do this. DeMarcus Cousins is sitting there probably more from a player standpoint than a team standpoint saying, I'd like to know if there's room for me somewhere else. So guys are impacted, but I had said last hour along the lines of what you're bringing up, I don't think Kawhi is doing it maliciously. They were talking earlier that when he was signing on at San Diego State, they didn't even know if he was going to be there until summer school started and he was there. This is Kawhi's personality. He relies on one person, his uncle Dennis Robertson, to give him advice, and evidently the advice right now is go slow. But there's no question you can do bad impact kind of scenarios inadvertently, CG. You can be malicious, you can be well-intentioned, but the result can be the same, and I think there's a danger of that happening now on that inadvertent side of this thing as the delay continues.
Well, your points are all spot on, Tony, and you're absolutely right that it is, in fact, the Lakers that are the most potentially adversely, I shouldn't say potentially, if he doesn't go with them, they are adversely affected. If he stays with Toronto, it's everything, you know, everything is status quo. And if Danny Green, I haven't heard anything today about Danny Green, so I'm a little out of the loop in that regard. But the Raptors come back the immediate favorite. I don't, you know, it's interesting, Tony, we heard for so long that the Clippers were really the place that he was going to go. And even though he said the Lakers early on, gradually that narrative shifted to the Clippers. And I'm not sure what it was that suddenly shifted his thinking on that. I wonder, Tony, is it as simple as Anthony Davis going to the Lakers and he didn't want to be on the team that didn't have a second star?
Well, I think that's part of it. Also, I should mention, if he gets it done by Sunday, for an Iguodala, for instance, it's probably not going to matter, and maybe Danny Green, is some guys have already come off the board that have impacted the Lakers, like Seth Curry. This is what I think, CG, in that regard, okay? I think what you have, and it's really complicated, I think you have elements with the Clippers that he really likes and elements with the Lakers that he really likes, but neither embodies everything that he wants. And I think there's certain, I mean, I think he loves the Clipper ownership. I think he has great respect for Doc Rivers and that stability and Jerry West and all of that. And I don't think it has anything to do with the glamour of the Lakers versus the Clippers. I don't think it has anything to do with it. It's the same building. And for him, I think he's just worried about what he would get going forward. I think he looks at it, and what you're talking about plays in. There's a bird in hand with the Lakers, and it has nothing to do long-term with LeBron. It has everything to do with the guy that he would probably be paired with as a running mate for years and years, and that's Anthony Davis. And with the Clippers, he sees a lot of hard-working, serviceable pieces, but no Batman to a Robin no matter what order you want to, you know, talk about, he doesn't see that. And I think this is what's taking so long. He said, if I could take this from column A, if I could take this aspect of Toronto, this aspect of the Lakers, and this aspect of the Clippers, I've got the perfect place. But life doesn't work that way, and I think that he's struggling with that. I think he looks at the Lakers and says, you know what? In a couple of years, as LeBron's getting ready to retire, this is perfect. But right now, I wouldn't have the heavy lifting there for a couple of years, but ultimately it would be my team. If I go with the Clippers, I probably have to work extremely hard again, and when I want to take those nights off, they may not like it. If I stay in Toronto, I can win again, but that's an awful long way from home. So I think everybody has their positives, and everybody has their negatives, and it's causing what I think is paralysis by analysis. That's my hunch right now.
Yeah, and I think to some extent, maybe even to a large extent, that's where my feeling about this has always gone back to. I think he knows where he wants to go, but I think the meetings, again, this is purely how I've viewed all the meetings. Let's just say that Toronto has been the lead horse for him, and that right. He's known that. I think the meetings have been, tell me why you're a better fit for me. Next team, tell me why you're a better fit for me. Goes back to Toronto, tell me why I should stay here. And I think you could shift those three as a starting point with any of the three. And Tony, I just wonder, when we get this announcement, and really this is becoming seemingly as important as the birth of a child, for heaven's sake, are we going to find ourselves saying, well, yeah, that makes perfect sense, or are we going to find ourselves saying, well, I didn't see that coming?
Well, I tell you what, I think because there is a little bit of column A, B, and C, you're going to be able to draw the logic on the positive side, or if you want to look on the negative side, I guess what I'm saying is, you're going to be able to make a case. You know the stuff when you go through forensics classes, et cetera, and they tell you to take, or if you go to law school, they tell you to take an argument on one side of the case, then argue the other side of the case?
Yep.
That, I think, is what you can do with this. But I will tell you something in regard to what you brought up. I think it's analogous to what we see with the replay in baseball in particular, but even football as well. The call on the field, right? You have to have conclusive evidence to overrule the call on the field. So what the umpire or the referee happened to say, that, though it might not be right, that is the thing that you have the burden of proof to supersede. I would say in that regard, Toronto is the call on the field, if that makes sense, at least from my point of view. And it means that he is saying what you're bringing up. All things being equal, he's headed back to Toronto, but he is giving the Lakers and the Clippers the chance to say and do things that will change his mind. But the tendency is back to Toronto. And I think at the end of the day, if it is, everybody had their strong suits, everybody had their downsides. I'm going back to Toronto because I didn't see anything compelling enough to overturn how I already feel. Because of that, and I'm talking about the 1-1, not the 5-year. The 1-1 leaves the door open for the Supermax and the chance to come home in a year if you don't care about the Supermax, or in 2, where you're still a very young guy, and then you know what the lay of the land is in both L.A. teams' cases.
Do you think there's any chance, because I've thought about this actually since you brought it up and certainly reading up a little bit on it, do you think there's any chance that Toronto's position, Tony, is, listen, we love you, we love what you've done for us, you've brought a whole country, put it on your back, you won us a championship, we're now in the NBA record books as a champion, we'd love to have you back, but if it's not for 4 years or 5 years, we're not going to do it.
Yeah, you know what, because they won the title, I doubt it. Had they not won the title, and this is what is so fascinating, and hasn't really come up very much, at least I find it of great interest, CG. I mentioned to you, the Warriors were one Steph Curry jumper away from forcing a Game 7 in that series. Now, they would have lost the game, that Sunday game in Toronto,
yep,
unless you would have had a Houston Rockets-like 0-for-27 performance, which Kawhi would not have allowed, because the Warriors were so undermanned. But let's go back and say that the injuries, never mind the injury to Durant, but the injury to Thompson, the one, not just the one that took him out, because people forget, and you know this, he was out in Game 3 because he was injured in Game 2. If Thompson would have been fully healthy and the Warriors would have gone ahead and won that series, I think it would have been an absolute no-brainer that Kawhi Leonard would be in Los Angeles right now, because he would be saying to himself, never mind the assembled media or anybody else, he'd be saying, look, they had the best player in the world, or one of them, along with myself and LeBron, out for the whole series, and they still beat us. There's no way that we are ready-made to win a title in Toronto. But because they won, I think he looks at Toronto and says, that is truly a place where we can win again because we just won. And I think that really complicates stuff a lot about the years. I think Toronto looks at it and says, if we can win again, if we look what the Warriors did. They won twice with Durant. I think they would have won three. But they are saying they're going to retire Durant's number because of the two championships. I don't think Toronto is worried beyond the next season if they feel they can win the whole thing, and that's what the victory that they just had did for their front office. They believe they can do it again, CG, because they just did it.
I completely concur with that. I know you and I have talked about that in the last month and a half, that there's no question the Raptors winning or losing had far more bearing on what Kawhi was going to do than the Warriors winning or losing and what KD was going to do.
You're correct. He was gone regardless. We found that out vividly in the last couple of weeks. All the stuff that has come out about distant second fiddle, about not liking Steve Kerr, about a comment.
Yep.
You know what's interesting? Since you brought up Michael Jordan, and you and I went through it, Michael, as you know, if he didn't have an enemy, he would invent one, okay? There's no doubt about it. He would go ahead and invent an enemy because if that was his emotional edge. There's no doubt that Kevin Durant, in a different way, invents enemies around him for whatever the reason. The difference is, like a jacket, Michael hung it up at night. Kevin Durant evidently lives it 24/7, 365.
Yeah, and you'll recall that I said, you had asked me a month ago, not quite a month ago, but you had asked me what I thought KD was doing, and I said for the longest time I thought he was going to stay, and then I switched to New York, and then I got the wrong New York. But when the news came out that he didn't get along with Steve Kerr, that really changes my view, Tony, on what you and I were discussing on Wednesday. And that, you know, what is it out there that makes KD happy? Because knowing Steve Kerr a little bit from my time in Chicago when he was there, and then following his career and seeing the kind of temperament he has, seeing what other players say about him, seeing what fellow colleagues of ours say about Kerr going on with him one-on-one, if you can't get along with Steve Kerr, then that really is on you. It points to you and nobody else, because Kerr is about as affable a guy as I've ever seen in professional sports. And for KD to have issues with him, then that just, I guess part of me says, well, okay, good luck in Brooklyn, happy trails. You're not going to win a title there, not the way this team is constructed there. Kyrie has already shown that he is not the magic pill to help a team win a title. All you have to do is look what he did or what he didn't do in Boston, and that's going to be another year anyway. And by the way, as long as you mention it, I'm not even sure what I make of the Warriors retiring his number for winning a couple of championships. Listen, I'm not down on KD at all. I loved watching him play in Oklahoma City, and I loved watching him with the Warriors. But is there a record somewhere for the fewest amount of years or seasons played on a team to get his number retired? This has to be right up there, Tony.
I'm glad you brought it up, because one of the emails that I didn't get on the list the other day had to do with what a guy you and I discussed, Kendrick Perkins, former teammate of KD, had been saying. Because as we talked, Perkins tried to act like he was reading the tea leaves, when in reality, everything he said obviously came right from Kevin Durant's camp, because he was right on the money about where Kevin was going and how he felt. And when he was pressed on it, because, you know, he's kind of new to the media, Perkins is, right? When he was pressed on it, he kind of backtracked, because you realize people around him were saying, the other colleagues, the other ESPN colleagues were saying, KP, what is it you know and why do you know it? And it was like, uh-oh, can't give up my source, right? Which clearly was within the confines of Kevin's group, his camp, Rich Kleiman, etc. But he's been right every time. And he made the comment the other day, and I didn't bring it up with you, but I found it of great interest. He said, yeah, the reason they're retiring Kevin's number is out of a guilty conscience. And that really, when he said guilty conscience, he meant that he felt that the Warriors, from Joe Lacob on down, felt they were responsible for forcing Kevin on the court. And I'm going to tell you one more time, CG, being a Warrior fan has nothing to do with this. I love Kevin Durant. I think he's the best player in the world when healthy. We'll see if he can come back from the Achilles. But for any player to claim he was pressured when he's the guy with the leverage, that is being disingenuous. Kevin played because Kevin chose to play. If he was feeling pressure, it was an internal situation that brought him on the court, period. The Warriors, in my opinion, did not honor him or are not honoring him because of guilt. They're honoring him out of pragmatism because Joe Lacob wants to make sure that every other free agent in the future knows the Warriors will not burn bridges behind them. And I think that's the reason for it.
Tony, I'm going to offer you a parallel to support what you just said. And that is, and I won't bury the lead. Sometimes you want to tell a guy like Kevin Durant, listen, I know that you think that you're the smartest person in the room, but there's actually quite a few people in here who've got you figured out and understand what you're actually saying and how you've just completely lost your mind with this. Reminds me of somebody that I worked with once who, when you had a disagreement with him, his voice would get louder and louder and louder, and he would start to yell. And I would say to him, you know, yelling doesn't make you right. And to the extent of Kevin Durant and where it applies there, Kevin hasn't learned something that a lot of our dads taught us, and that is just because you say it doesn't mean it's truth. And Kevin likes to tell people in the room, and, you know, a lot of these athletes like Russell Westbrook, and, yeah, I'm grouping a little bit. Maybe I'm putting too many guys into one box. But a lot of these guys will just act like everybody in the room is ignorant, and only they know what's going on. And they'll say things that just defy logic. And you look at them and say, what are you talking about? And they'll come up with some clever, well, you know, I'm just being me. And it's like, okay, that doesn't really answer the question. And Kevin Durant falls, Tony, Kevin Durant falls squarely into that group.
Well, I tell you what, along those lines, and I agree with you, and like I said, I think Kevin's a good person. He's done a ton for the people in D.C. I think he's one of the greatest players in NBA history. He's also an outstanding teammate. So I don't have anything bad to say about him in regard to on the court or off, except when the thing at Oklahoma City came up again the other day, and you and I have talked about Stephen A. Smith. It's an interesting case in point. A lot of what Stephen A. does is hype and bluster. I mean, he and Max Kellerman, I can guarantee you, before they go on in the morning, there's a lot of good cop, bad cop. You know, I joked around about the old days of big-time wrestling when I was a kid, and a guy like Pepper Gomez was a hero here, but the villain in San Jose, and the guy who was the villain here was the hero in San Jose. It was all part of the game, right? That there's a lot of that gamesmanship, that hot take, I'm going to go this way, you go that way. But through it, Stephen A. Smith, also a longtime veteran NBA writer, and the other day, when he went on air, and he knows Durant's watching. They know this. This thing about Kevin. So one difference between Kevin and Michael Jordan, Michael Jordan never gave a bleep what anybody said about him. You and I both know it, okay?
Yep.
It's just all there was to it. He might not have liked it, and he would tell you, but it never impacted his life one bit. If anything, it gave him more fuel. But when Stephen A. came out the other day and said there was the reason for the animosity between KD and Russell Westbrook wasn't merely that Russell was not informed that Kevin was leaving, but that they had a dinner where Kevin, with teammates, including Russell, there before he met with the Warriors in the Hamptons, guaranteed them he was just taking the meeting out of courtesy, and he was coming back to OKC. And they said the next thing they knew, he was at a press conference on July 4th in Oakland with the Warriors. And KD evidently texted Stephen A. Smith and said, that's BS, using a much more strong way of saying BS. And Stephen A. Smith came back on the air and said, I stand by what I say. And then at the end of the show the other day, the end of First Take, Stephen A. said that Kevin is trying to claim it was BS because it wasn't a dinner that he was supposed to have set it around. Now, CG, that's going after the tangent that has nothing to do with the actual substance of what was said, right? Whether it was a dinner or a lunch or you were sitting around having a cold one, you don't call it BS when you're not talking about the content. You're just talking about the locale. And that told me, if that's true, that Kevin was trying to dodge the issue and not tell the full truth about that.
Yeah, no, you're right. That all makes sense. And I want to add something to what you said about KD a minute ago, you know, that you don't have any problems with him on the court, off the court, and so on. Yeah, I've been that way the whole time, and I've been a big defender of his. I think that he is a good guy. Obviously, he has shown himself to be the greatest player in the world when he's on the court. He's a guy who, as you said, has done so much for the D.C. community, and he's worked, if not tirelessly, near tirelessly in the Bay Area to do the same types of things in his adopted community. But I would add this caveat, that sometimes athletes say and do things just like writers, just like hosts, entertainers, authors who are in the public eye. They take a position on something or they act a certain way, and it goes more to athletes where it's like the relationship where you're starting dating somebody, Tony, and you start seeing some things that rub you the wrong way, but because you want it to work so badly, you're happily ready to shove those under the carpet and not think about it. But at some point down the line in that relationship, those things that bugged you early on are going to bug you now. And I think sometimes we've seen some of these things with Kevin early on, even back in Oklahoma City days, but tended to ignore it, knowing that, you know what, he's going to be great for the Warriors. And then when they start to sort of show themselves again, it doesn't mean that you like him, not you, but you like him any less as a player. But it's another chapter in the book that can't be ignored because it still is a part of who he is.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, I want to move away from this for the moment because I want to address Rick's email before we run out of time because it always flies by. I was mentioning to Marcus last hour, the email hours on Friday, just a great amount of fun. But I had mentioned to you that Steve Nash had visited. Steve Nash, of course, great, great Hall of Fame player and someone who's a Warrior consultant, had visited KD after the first championship a couple summers ago. And he said Kevin was thoroughly depressed that everything he thought would be there for him, had the MVP, had the trophy, it didn't have the meaning. And I do think when, you know, you and I talked about the matter of semantics, I call him, you know, a guy who is forever searching. Ramona Shelburne calls it being a seeker, which I think is a more kind way to say it. But either way, it's someone, and in his early 30s, looking for fulfillment. He has everything on the surface that the rest of us would certainly like to have. He has tremendous athletic talent. He has great name recognition. He is great at something that it's a lot of fun to play. He's unbelievably generationally wealthy forever and a day. Everybody, when they see him coming, they welcome him with open arms. Yet through it, he still is finding an emptiness. And you know what? You said it the other day, and I agree with you. I don't think he is going to find the fulfillment in Brooklyn. I don't think so. Whether he wins or not, there's a different issue going on with him. Maybe it'll come with maturity. You and I both know this. Age is a necessary but not sufficient condition for maturity. So maybe he's just not old enough yet to figure out how great he's got it at the moment. But I really mean it. Because I had an email that said, hey, you know what, he'll be back with the Warriors someday. Maybe he will. Maybe he'll look back, and this would be the cry and shame. It's about a trade that hurts both teams. If both organizationally, the Warriors, and Kevin personally look back in 10 years and go, never should have broken this thing up. And CG, people around the Bulls say the same thing. People around the Oakland A's said the same thing in the 70s. There are extenuating circumstances, but many times all that lives on is the regret, and you can't get it back.
I count me in the group right now, and you're not going to see a flip-flop on me on this. And, you know, never say never. I am. If there is a camp that I had to fall into, Tony, it's 10 years from now, Durant, publicly or privately, will say, what was I thinking? Why did I leave one of the greatest situations any player could ever be in? You and I, you reference the Bulls. Everybody in Chicago, the late Jerry Krause, with all due respect to him, he had a lot of greatness in him in the way he analyzed players and brought players to the Bulls. But one thing that he didn't have was tact and people skills, and he went out and said, I can't wait to see how we do and how long it'll take us to win another title when Michael and this team is broken up. Well, that happened a few months later because none of them wanted to play for the Bulls anymore because of Jerry Krause. And last I checked, the Bulls are 21 or 22 years running without having won.
Yep. Rick Barry the other day talking about this, and Rick would know because he made some problematic moves, as you're well aware, including leaving for the ABA because it was father-in-law that was running the Miami team, to leaving the Warriors after a title shortly thereafter. And he just said, I do not, just like you said, he goes, I do not understand what KD's thinking. He's got the world by the tail here, and he just doesn't know it. Look, I hope it works out for him. I hope he goes to Brooklyn, whether he wins titles or not. I hope he's very happy because, obviously, whatever the case was, the Warriors know now they could not have made him happy. That's all there is to it. CG, I want to ask you about Rick's email because I mentioned this to my wife in passing, and the response that Rick got at the end of his email is actually the response I got as well. Rick wrote in and said, somebody please tell Alex, meaning Alex Morgan, to count me, Rick, amongst those who hearing to, as Alex calls it, a double standard in regard to what happened the other day and what has happened a few times now with the great women's national soccer team that will, of course, play the Netherlands on Sunday for the World Cup title. He said, I love the team, so it's not about me disliking women's sports. I love the team, but their on-field comportment leaves me feeling there's much to be desired. On a related note, he said his wife told him to go bleep himself. Is it a double standard? Let's just look specifically. There have been other incidents, but you are playing on a worldwide platform. You are the best team in the world. You know you are in Europe, admittedly in France, not in England, but you take time in a highly competitive match that, frankly, you were lucky to win, and you're sipping tea to mock the English folks. Was it something, if a guy did it, it would have been water off a duck's back? Is Alex right?
We have a phrase. I use with my daughters, and that's be the duck. Let the water roll off your back. I agree with Rick's wife. I think this is way too much being made over sipping friggin' tea. I can't tell you, and you have watched as much of this over the years as I have, how many times on the men's side I have watched players from Italy, Germany, Argentina, Brazil, I mean, one country after another going through elaborate celebrations, ripping off the shirt and running the length of side to side, and just one thing after another, or football players with the bowling pins with the Eagles or the eating food of the Vikings. You don't hear Joe Buck. You don't hear Joe Buck and Troy Aikman breaking down and analyzing what they're doing in the end zone. You don't hear Marv Albert or Mike Breen breaking down a celebration after a dunk. I do think it's much ado about nothing. I'll add this. I did find it distasteful when the Americans were winning that first game, the American team 13-0, and they were still celebrating at goals 9 through 13. That bothered me because the match was over. But they have nothing but the utmost respect for England. They made that clear before the match and after the match. And for a little sip of tea, and I made a joke on Twitter, listen, two sips of tea, that's breaking the unwritten rules. One sip is allowable. I think it's too much. I don't know if it's a double standard per se, if you want to call it that, because maybe it is. I don't know that it's about women. I don't know what it is. I just think it's gotten to the point of being ridiculous. This team is fantastic. They play their butts off out there, and if Alex Morgan or whomever wants to act like she's sipping tea, so what?
Your points are on the money. I agree with you in substance, CG. I do have to ask you, though. Alex got into that situation at Disney World, which turned pretty ugly. She has apologized about it. Do those things at all play into this? Because you and I both know the subculture, and boy, we know it well, the subculture of being a basketball player means you are going to have bleep talking sent your way every second of the day. You tell me anytime, CG, you ever went anywhere, organized ball pickup games, where there wasn't at least some person yapping nonstop about it. Is it something we're just not used to on the women's side that in reality is happening when, say, women's basketball players get together? We just are not used to it the way we are. We assume it happens with the men, so it carries over into every sport, including soccer, and we're just not used to hearing or seeing it.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And I think, you know, the whole Disney, the Epcot Center situation, I mean, that's unfortunate. And I think sometimes, though, Tony, a lot of folks out there, meaning people in our business, and fans are guilty of it just as much, start to conflate things. They start to take one incident and say, well, because that individual, male or female, did that at Epcot Center or did something at the Golden Gate Bridge or did something at Mount Rushmore, whatever the case may be, we then cast a much more glaring eye and we are scrutinizing them that much more, so that as soon as they do the smallest thing that might in and of itself in a singular act not draw attention to itself, because there was something that happened beforehand, we are now going to let that go from 2 on a 1 to 10 scale to 73. And I think she is, I think you're right. I think that weighs into it. But I think sometimes we have to be careful, no matter who we're talking about, to remember to look at and judge or analyze every situation on its own merits, good or bad, and not conflate them.
I agree, and I'll tell you, when I brought it up about I'm talking to some WNBA players, and they said, you know what, the junk that's being talked when the women are playing is exactly the same as the men. You just aren't aware of it. So, you know, maybe it's the nature of sport, right, because we always have somebody around you challenging you in some way or another verbally while you're trying to play, that's for sure.
Yes.
All right, one last thing. Nan had emailed in about Coco Gauff, who won today. Again, and Nan actually emailed in before the match wrapped up. It was a great comeback. She mentioned the 15-year-old from Florida is precisely what the world of the professional tennis needs right now. Your feeling, CG, in the last 2 minutes, about the re-energizing of a sport. I mean, Sloane Stephens, of course, local. We love watching her. The men's side, you know, the Nadals of the world, et cetera, have been around an awful long time. Is this a fresh face that the sport, forget the gender, but the sport needs right now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm somebody who admittedly will say on the program to anybody who talks to me, we don't really talk a lot about tennis because I'm not passionately engaged in it. Coco Gauff has gotten me to watch. She has gotten me seeking out her highlights, seeking out her story. And, yeah, it could be Coco Gauff or it could be Charlie Gauff. Gender doesn't matter. I think it's cool that she is a woman and that she's American. I love all of that. And she reminds me of when Chrissy Everett came on the scene, when
right.
a younger Jimmy Connors came on the scene, when John McEnroe, for different reasons, came on the scene. I think tennis right now, and a lot of ardent tennis fans would disagree with me, but for me, tennis has become homogenized. Everybody looks, sounds, and plays like they all come out of that IMG or whatever it is, academy down in Florida. They all look like automatons to me. Nobody stands out in a different way. She does, Tony. And the aggressiveness, the brilliance of her play, the way she strategizes, and she is 15 years old, she will get me to the TV set to watch.
Well, she and Halep will go at it in the next round, and it'll be interesting to see if it's going to be center court, because she has become the cause celeb in Great Britain as well. And you nailed it, CG, and I hope you have a great weekend, and you and I will talk on Monday. But this is a story that the sport itself needed, and it has to do with not just being 15-year-old, not just being a woman, but being just a refreshing kind of oasis in what has become a lot of sameness, which is applicable in a lot of sport when the same people are always there. CJ, appreciate it, my friend. Have a great weekend. We will talk on Monday at 3:35, and you'll be up, and I'll be up at 2:05. You'll be up at 3:05, and we'll get back after it. Take care. Sure. All right, guys. Christopher Gabriel will take a break, wrap it up, send you off to Nick and Nick in just a few minutes. Then the Giants come up on 940, and the A's will be over on 790 a little bit later on 50,000 watt 940 ESPN. Hi, buddy. Welcome back. Thanks, of course, to Russ for his time throughout the 2 hours. Marcus in hour one, CG in hour two. Nick and Nick coming up momentarily. They'll take you 4 to 6 with the Zone. Giants 6:35 tonight on 947.15 first pitch. They're back home with a four-game winning streak. Back home to play the Cardinals. And over on 790, the A's, after finishing their series at home against Minnesota, they're up in Seattle. They will have a 6:45 pre and a 7:10, I think, first pitch. You want to be precise. Up in Seattle on 790. Also, in the last minute or so here, I want to pass along our well wishes to our friend Teddy Bruschi, of course, Bay Area native, Roseville, California. Standout in high school, great guy, terrific college career, of course, at Arizona, and a Super Bowl champion with the New England Patriots, and someone you see on a regular basis on ESPN. Also, his family from a part of Italy that my family comes from as well, but Teddy suffered another stroke. You know, he had one in 2005. Had to do with a congenital effect in his heart, a small hole in his heart, and he overcame all of that, the paralysis, the numbness, the blindness, all thankfully partial and all temporary, came back to play and continued on and won Super Bowls, etc. But now he had another stroke, and he is at the moment, from what we're being told, rehabbing once again, and I hope at age 46, really any age, but at age 46 in particular, being such a young, vibrant guy and having so much in front of him career-wise in broadcasting and his family and everything, that he makes, again, a full recovery. But it's jarring to know that it's happened again. And so our best wishes go out to Teddy Bruschi and his entire family and all the folks that know him very well. Okay, we're going to wrap things up. Remind you guys that we'll be back with you Monday at 2:05. CG will be up at 3:05. And to the one emailer about the Giants, I hope this is the start of a great run toward a title in the NL West. I know you finished it with LOL, and I don't blame you, so I assume you're not a Dodger fan giving me a hard time. The Giants are going to have to be sellers come trade deadline at the end of this month, but it's nice to know they are at least capable of playing some good ball on occasion, at the very least when the Padre pitching staff is in front of them. We'll see how it goes against the Cardinals tonight, and we'll talk all about it on Monday, and we'll see where Kawhi Leonard is by Monday. This is KFIG Fresno.